Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Tim brings us a message where we consider the question, what is marriage for? As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Tim.
And if I haven't met you yet, my name is Tim, and we're glad you're with us this morning. And before we dive into some scripture again this morning, one quick announcement. A couple of months ago, earlier this month, we had a kind of a church business meeting, and in that meeting, we talked about how we still carry some debt on this facility, and a number of you said, hey, we would be willing or would love the opportunity to kind of lean into that. And we, as a church, have been trying to set aside money as we've had excess to say, let's pay off this debt as quickly as we can. Some of you have said, hey, we would love to help with that. And so, first off, thank you. If that's you, thank you. We did set up a designated fund. You can give online through, it's just one of the top, the drop-down menu options. I think it's called SH Facility Debt or something like that. Or you can give, via check or however you want to give that way too. But thank you for those of you who are willing. We'll at some point talk more about that. Thank you. If you have a Bible, we are going to pick up where we left off last week in Ephesians chapter 5. We are not done with Song of Songs. We'll get to Song of Songs once again this morning. We are in our second to last week, and so we're going to wrap this thing up well. The ending is the best part of Song of Songs. But before we get there, we left with some kind of a little bit heavier theology lesson last week. Want to pick that back up this morning. We got a little more theology, and then for those of you who are like, but yeah, I just want to, like, I think I understand what this means, but how does this look? Like, what does this look like lived out? For those of you who think that way, we'll get really practical this morning as best I can on how do we get practical? How do we actually do this kind of practical? But let's pick up where we left off. Ephesians chapter 5, this is, kind of, I called it last week, a marriage advice column written by a pastor to a church that he planted. The author's name is Paul, and he, in the middle of a longer letter, he gives the longest and the clearest teaching in our whole New Testament on marriage. And we camped out in this line, verse 21 of chapter 5, where Paul says to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. That is the engine of everything that's going to come after this. And we made the case last week, do not separate verse 22 and verse 21. Verse 22 says, wives, submit to your husbands. But verse 21 and 22 hang together. We are to submit to one another. And then what Paul will do is he'll say, okay, this is what this is going to look like for wives. And this is what this is going to look like for husbands. But together, Paul is not creating a hierarchy. Paul actually is really clear that in a healthy marriage, in a Christ-centered marriage, we should have mutual self-sacrifice, mutual submission, mutual surrender, mutual place them above yourselfness. That should happen. And so he'll say, submit to one another, then wives, here's what this looks like. Husbands, here's what that's going to look like for you. And then to wrap that up, he's going to anchor the whole thing in the very first marriage. It's actually the same spot that Jesus, when he talks about marriage, is going to anchor it in. It's Genesis chapter 2, verse 31. He quotes, I'm sorry, Ephesians 5, verse 31. He quotes Genesis chapter 2, I think it's like 26, something like that. But he says this, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. You've probably heard that verse before. It's in just about every wedding that you've been to. And what Paul does here is quite brilliant. What Paul's doing here is he recognizes that it's possible in his world, and I think in our world, that we can spend a lot of time talking about what a marriage is and never ask the question that's beneath the question, which is, what is a marriage for? What is a marriage for? Why marriage? And Paul says this next. He says, this is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ in the church. So after giving this long list of like, hey, here's how we're going to do marriage as Christians. Like, this is Pastor Paul's recommendation to his church. He says, okay, back up a minute. The reason we're having this longer conversation is because behind a healthy marriage, the profound mystery is somehow in our marriage, we point a world who may not know our God or believe in our God, we point them to what our God is like. When he treats her a certain way and she treats him a certain way, something in that is so countercultural that when people see it, they say, oh, that must be prompted by their God. That must be a little bit of what the heart of God is like. Now, where does Paul get this idea? Again, he roots it in the book of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 2, we read that two will become one flesh. Now, I'm going to nerd out on you just for a minute, and then we'll get practical. So let me nerd out for a minute. The word for one here, what is it? The two will be one flesh. Every wedding you've been to, when you've heard that, the word is a Hebrew word, and the word that we translate one is a Hebrew word ahad. 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 Now, ahad's an interesting word. There's another Hebrew word that you could use here to talk about like two becoming one new thing. That's not the word. If I said I have one laser pointer, there's another word to say I have one laser pointer. That's not ahad. Ahad is a unified plurality. So it's a word that's used to say that there's multiple things, but when those things come together, they make up like one new thing. You could say, The reason the Lions are going to beat the Eagles today is because they played as one team, right? That's going to happen, and that's what we'll say. Or you could say, together we are one nation. Now, there are many people in that one nation, many states, many cities, many townships in that, but one people, one part, one unity. That's the word that Genesis uses for a marriage. He is still he and she is still she, but when they come together, something in them coming together makes up this whole new thing. It's a unity within the plurality. Genesis 2 is one of the most quoted verses in the entire Bible. Jesus quotes it, Paul quotes it. People keep coming back to it. And as quoted as it is, it's not the number one most quoted verse in our Bible that carries the word ahad in it. There is another verse. It's actually the most quoted verse in the entire Old Testament. It is the most quoted verse in the Old Testament by Jesus of the Old Testament. You may know the verse. I'll give it to you in Hebrew. Some of you are going to recognize it because I think some of the kids in the Christian schools are learning this in Hebrew. And if you come to Israel or Turkey with us, Greece, you have learned these words, but some of you know the phrase Shema Yisrael, Adonai, Eloheinu, Adonai, Echad. Same word there. It's a prayer known as the Shema. It is it's in Deuteronomy 6 in our Bible, and it's a prayer of commitment. Every morning, faithful Jewish people at the time of Jesus would commit themselves to God by saying, Shema, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, or the Lord alone. And every evening, before they shut their eyes, they would recommit themselves to God by saying the Shema. Now, here's where this I find to be really, really interesting. The word God uses for a husband and a wife becoming one is the same word that is used of who God is. Paul says this is a profound mystery. Marriage is a profound mystery. Something in a marriage, when we get it right, it actually points somehow to God. And if you've ever tried to explain the Trinity, you ever notice how trying to explain the Trinity is really difficult? Like, God is three, but God is one. And then no matter what metaphor we use to explain the Trinity, eventually you end up with a big fancy Christian word is heresy. They almost always break down. It's like, okay, God is like an egg, and you got the shell, and you got the white stuff, and then you got the yolk in the middle, and then somebody's going to come along and say, no, that's modalism. And it's like, okay, God is like water, and you've got, you know, ice, and you got steam, and you've got liquid, and three are one. And you say, well, no, that's partialism. It's almost always heresy. But the Bible actually gives us a word, gives us a picture, a human picture to understand a divine truth, and it's a marriage. When we get this right, actually, it somehow shows us what the heart of our God is like and how the three persons of God interact and work together. That's your theology lesson. Now, let's talk about how. How do we do this? Because that's easy to say. How do you do it? How do you do it? Two people are very different. My wife and I are very different. I grew up, I'm a Dutch man. She's an Italian woman. The Dutch and the Italian solve problems differently. And so How do you actually do this? How do you do it? How do two become one? Pastor Paul tells us, this is what he says, the next line. So this is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and his church. However, each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. Now, on the surface, that feels like, okay, that sounds like a Paul thing to say, like a powerful, but what does it mean? Like a Paul thing to say. But I remember where I was when I heard this passage unpacked for me, and it was somewhere between 13 and 14 years ago. I know that because 14 years ago I got married, and 13 years ago I came to South Harbor, and it was somewhere in the middle because I was leaving my old church, and I was driving to my house. I lived then in Hudsonville, and I was in my Chevy Blazer. Love that car, but it just drank gas, and at that point, gas was really expensive. But I was in my Chevy Blazer, and I was listening to a podcast by a gentleman by the name of Emerson Eggerich. Weird name, I know, but have anybody heard of Emerson Eggerich? Yeah, love and respect. Okay, so for those of you who have, you know how good this is. But for those of you who haven't, this was so helpful to me in my first year of marriage. Emerson Eggerich, he writes a book called Love and Respect. Emerson Eggerich is a pastor, but he's also what's his technical title? He's also a practicing psychologist. And so what he said absolutely jarred me. He said, okay, what we see here, and we talked about this last week, this is Paul's big point in Ephesians. Husbands and wives are equal. That is true. Husbands and wives are equal. We are equally loved by God. Men and women are equally loved by God. Men and women deserve equal treatment, equal pay for equal work. That is true. We are equal. Paul's the first person to name that we are equal. There's no longer male nor female in Christ. Somehow, however, men and women are not the same. Okay, so equal doesn't mean same. We are not the same. Jesus said it like this. Have you not read that when the Lord God made them, he made them male and female? We're different. We're not better, not worse, but we are different. Men and women have different needs. We have different ways of communicating those needs. And when we struggle to communicate those needs, it often results in conflict. There are many good couples that find themselves in conflict, not because their intentions aren't good. Their intentions are good. Like they said yes to each other. Their intentions are really, really good. And yet they often find themselves in these moments of conflict. And so why do we have conflict? Sometimes it simply comes down to communicating our needs or our wants or our wishes or our desires. We communicate them different. Let me give you a couple of examples. Think about how we talk. Okay, so she says, I have nothing to wear. What does she mean? I have nothing new. I've worn all that. He says, I have nothing to wear. What does he mean? I have nothing clean. Right? What I love about that example is it's the same words, right? Same words, and yet you kind of know that we mean different things. We are wired different, and sometimes this comes out in conflict. Think about so she says to him, I think I need to go on a diet. I'm getting a little bit fat. Okay, she says that to him. He says, well, I love her. I'm going to go out to the bookstore, and I'm going to go buy her a book on how to diet. And he presents her with that book. Does she like that gift? No. Yeah, no. Are you saying I'm fat? Are you saying I need to go on a diet? Okay. She buys him a book on dieting. Maybe a little bit offensive, but most likely he says, cool, what's for dinner? Like, right? Not as a big of a deal. She buys him a book on how to have a healthier marriage. What is he thinking? She doesn't like our marriage. She doesn't think I'm a good husband. She doesn't think I'm good enough. He buys her a book on how to have a healthier marriage. He loves me so much. She's telling her friends, can you believe it? I married the best man. He wants to continue to work on our marriage. Men and women are different. Men and women are different. Not better, not worse, just different. And if we do not understand the ways we communicate, it can result in conflict. So the question on the table is, why conflict when our intentions in our marriages are often really, really good? And Paul gives two commands, one to women and one to men, one to wives, and one to husbands. And there are different commands. When Paul addresses them as a bigger group, he says that we are to all do both. All people should respect, and all people should love. However, when he specifically addresses wives, he says, wives, I need you to respect your husbands. And when he specifically addresses husbands, he says, husbands, you better love your wife. He gives different commands, different instructions. Now, why would Paul command husbands to love and wives to respect? Why do that? There was one of the leading quantitative researchers on marriage, a guy by the name of John Gottman from the University of Washington, studied 2,000 couples for 20 years. And he summarized his findings on what makes a successful couple a successful marriage. Like what makes for a successful marriage? You know his findings. He said, husbands, yeah, you need to learn how to communicate love to your wife. And wives, you really need to learn how to communicate respect to your husbands. That was his summary. He also said that the worst piece of a marriage, like the thing we should be really, really careful, is contempt. That was his big takeaway of contempt is like a marriage killer. But isn't it fascinating that God, or Paul, 2,000 years ago gave the same advice that our leading researchers are now saying, hey, we did 20 years, studied 2,000 couples. Same advice. Now, do we all need love and respect equally? Yes, we do. Men need respect. Our women need respect. Men need love. That is true. But Paul is highlighting a difference between husbands and wife that we should pay attention to, especially during conflict. Another study. There was a study done asking 7,000 people this question. When you're in a conflict with your spouse, do you feel unloved at that moment, or do you feel disrespected at that moment? 83% of the men said they feel disrespected. 72% of the women said they feel unloved. Now, that difference should scream at us. And by the way, just know 83 is not 100%. There's still like a 20% gap there of men who say, no, I feel unloved in that moment. And there's still a 30% gap of women who say they feel disrespected in this moment. These are not boxes to push people into, men and women into. We got to be really careful. That's not what I'm trying to say. These are tendencies that tend to be true. Not everyone's going to fit the tendencies. Your marriage is unique. You are unique. You hear me on this? Before you give me an email saying, that's not how it plays out. Right, you're unique. You're all snowflakes, individually crafted. Okay. Every couple's unique. However, there are tendencies that Paul saw in his world that I think, having met with many couples, I think you may see in your marriage too. I see it in my marriage as well. Why would God command then men to love their wives? Perhaps it's because for men, love, intimacy, affection do not come as naturally for men as they do for women. It's not the place we go. Women, it's a little bit easier. Now, again, we're speaking in generalizations, not true for everyone, but tends to be that in women, God has placed this intimacy and nurturing in women at a different level than men. Liza and I, when we're in a conflict, I'm never worried about whether she still loves me, right? She can't not do that. Unless there's abuse or trauma early in life, naturally women are, they're nurturers. That tends to be their nature. Now, so why does Paul not have to command women to love? Because why would you have to command women to do what they've already been designed to do? God's already wired them to do that. But for men, husbands, does this come as naturally to us? The nurturing, I'll ask it this way. Did you instantly bond with your children as quickly as she did? Do you naturally find yourself drawn to Hallmark movies? Maybe you do. Why would God command women to respect their husbands? It Perhaps, because it is in the nature of, it's not in the nature of women to respect as easily as it is to love, and it's a little bit more in the nature to respect a little bit. Men kind of speak an honor code. Guys tear, I've seen grown men tear up at the gladiator. Strength and honor. Right? Like that's, now, again, generalizations, absolutely generalizations, but men and women are different. Not better, not worse, just different. My point, hear me on this, is that there's something in our nature that which leads us to be different. And Paul says that because of this, sometimes we need to put on the things that are of Christ, but do not come naturally to us. That is true for other things too. You may not naturally be a joy-filled person, but you have to choose to put that on because we're called to put that on. You may not naturally want to offer forgiveness, but you put on forgiveness. So it's Paul's language. Now, what happens in conflict? Think about conflict. Typically, there is some kind of a trigger, right? Something happens. Sometimes it's small things, right? Like you left your socks on the ground again. Sometimes it's bigger things, but there's some kind of a trigger. Something happens, and you're both upset. Typically, one of the two of you, I'll let you choose which one, is going to bring that thing up quicker, right? Almost always. Tends to be the case. It's not a bad thing. Somebody needs to call it out. Something happens. There's a trigger. Now, remember, it's in her nature in this moment. It's in her nature to love. So what often happens is, okay, let's say she's upset, and she brings it up, and she's kind of mad that this happened. Can't keep going on like this. So she brings it up. Now, if she's not really careful, she can accidentally communicate that thing in a way that comes off to him as disrespectful. Not that he's worried for a second that she doesn't love him still, but she might worry, he might not actually feel very respected in that moment. So how does he respond? Okay, so she says something and it comes off not exactly respectful. How does he respond? Typically, like one of two ways, right? One, he explodes. That's sometimes the case. But most of the time, from my anecdotal experience, he gets quiet. The silent treatment. Because if you're going to disrespect me, I am not going to disrespect you back, so I'll just get quieter. I'll shut down. To which she receives that is, that's not very loving. So that's not very loving, and I need him to hear. So I'll speak it louder. To which he responds, well, that's not very respectful, so he shuts down more. And there's she needs love, so she's going to speak it even louder. There's like a void in her, like, am I safe here? Do you even care? Do you even care about this? To which he does care, he just doesn't want to disrespect her back. And round and round and round we go. She gets louder, he gets quieter. She acts more disrespectful, he acts more unloving. Emerson Eggerich refers to this as the crazy cycle. Many of us get stuck on the crazy cycle, not because our intentions aren't good, but because we are wired different. And it's another Tuesday night ruined by what? Like something that started small that just two people with good intentions that just didn't know how to connect those intentions. Now, here's why Paul's advice, I think, is really helpful in that one little line. It's really simple advice. Paul says, submit to one another. Last week we said the word submit literally means to put their desires above your desires. So it's men choosing to start with love and women choosing to start with respect. It's submission means that every time you're in kind of that moment when things are getting escalated, men, every word you say, and have a conversation. If this is not the two of you, if you're not wired this way, then put on what they need out of you. But if this is you, men, every single word you say gets filtered through the question, how does this communicate to her that I love her, that she's safe? Now, volume here matters. Too loud, no good. Too quiet, also no good, okay? And I preach to myself on this one. And Dutch people are very good at the quiet treatment. See? Women, every word you say is filtered to the question, is the way I'm talking to him now showing him that I respect him? Phrases like, grow up. be a man, take responsibility. No, bad. Paul calls when we do that, when we actually are working to put on what they need. The word Paul uses is submission. It's like a reciprocal dance where you are both working really hard to meet the other person in the thing that she needs or he needs. Now, here's where Paul's advice gets critical. I'm going to draw it, but it's such an easy drawing that I'm going to draw it, and you're going to think, why did you waste our time dragging the whiteboard out? Because it's an easy drawing. But there is a drawing, and the reason I'm going to draw it for you is because I want you to draw it. If you have your devotional, I think you should draw this. I remember when this was drawn for me, and so I'm passing along some of the best stuff that was given to me. But it's a simple drawing. You're going to see it, and you're going to say, like Michelle Tanner from Full House, duh. Okay, simple drawing. Draw a dot on one side of the paper. Okay. Then on the other side of the paper, draw another dot. This dot, you can write you or me, but this dot, I'm going to write husbands. And then this dot, I'm going to write wives. Can you read that at all? It's two dots. You don't have to read it. Wives, husbands. Okay. Now, what often happens in argument, okay? What tends to happen is something happens, and there's probably somebody in your relationship that's the first to apologize to most of the time. But what often happens is, especially early in marriage, like, okay, let's say something happens, and she's quicker to apologize, and so she's going to cross over, and she's going to go to him, and he's stonewalling her, and she's going to say, I'm so sorry. I need this to be better. This isn't good. I don't like this. We're better than this. Okay, so she's going to do that work. And he's hopefully going to receive that. I understand. And every once in a while, he's going to do the same. He's going to cross over and say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Like, that wasn't my best self. Okay, so that's early marriages. That tends to be what happens. And then you're going to reach a moment, and you're like 2 to 5. And you're going to realize, oh, there's a better way to do this. Maybe you went through counseling, and there's a better way to do this. And what you realize is, I'm not completely at fault here. That was a little bit crazy, but you were a little bit crazy too. So what if we could meet in the middle and I'll apologize what I can apologize for and you can apologize for what you need to apologize for and we'll call that compromise. We'll meet in the middle. Compromise. Many good couples, this is like they find this and it helps. It really helps. It's like the next level. They've reached the next level. But there's another next level. There's a better level. The Bible insists this. Paul insists this. Jesus insists this. There's another level. And again, this is where you're going to say, duh. There's a third dot. Anybody want to guess what the third dot is? God. Solomon writes a book called Song of Songs. And Song of Songs is this love poem. He writes another book that's like really kind of depressing on the surface called Ecclesiastes. In Ecclesiastes, he says, two are better than one, but a cord of three strands. You've been to weddings. A cord of three strands is not easily broken. There's a third strand in our relationships that Jesus insists you really need this. And Paul insists we really need this. Here's what can happen. So let's say he decides individually he's going to commit his life to getting to know God better. And she decides individually she's going to commit her life to getting to know God better. They decide they're going to do some stuff together so that they can grow in their faith. And every step of the way, they reach these new layers of maturity and growth the older that they get. The Bible uses the fancy word sanctification. They just get closer to God. Now, think about the distance between, let's say they've been married 10 years and they've learned some tricks. And so now she's there and he's there and there's an argument. There's less room to travel, is there not? Now, imagine a life of this. You, over the course of a life, have these moments. Chapter 1 of Song of Songs, they're not there yet at all. Right? She needs all kinds of reassurance. He needs all kinds of reassurance. They're not even kind of there. But by chapter 8, we're going to see a different couple. if you give your life to this, it's possible that you get so close that, okay, yes, there's an argument and a conflict, but it's almost like we're now, there's just less space between the two. It's almost like we've become ahad, like we've become one. Now, the risk here is, let's say she grows, and so she's here, and he decides, I don't want to do anything. I'm kind of done growing. There's still the same distance, right? That's still the same distance. And so like you're still dealing with the same kinds of stuff. But if you grow together, this is why we encourage this all the time. If you take next steps together, either individually toward God or together toward God, you may discover that actually some of the stuff that was holding your marriage back, actually you can deal with it a little bit better. Now, but kind of helpful. Oh yeah, that was a clap. That's somebody liked it. Good, thank you. I find it kind of helpful. I'm gonna block Craig just for now. Craig, don't worry, I'll move it. Some of you are like, the pictures are helpful, but I need a story. Give me a story. I want to see this lived out. Song of Songs chapter 8. We have the story. We've been following this couple for a little bit. We saw them meet each other. We saw them date. We saw them fall in love. We saw them get married. We saw the early marriage fights. Last week, we talked about them older, and we're picking up there. Chapter 8 is the last chapter in Song of Songs, and they are now older. The friends see them in a distance, and notice how the friends describe them. This line's incredible. Verse 5, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? That verse is loaded. She is leaning, not clinging, not collapsing, not controlling, not competing. She is leaning. Leaning is language of trust, right? Leaning is language of respect. I can trust you. I can lean on you. I can respect your strength. The wife in this moment is meeting her husband's deepest longing to feel respected and necessary and helpful. And she's, do you trust me? Do you believe in me? Do you see what I'm trying to bring here? It's a posture. Leaning is a posture of respect. And again, they weren't there in chapter 1, 2, 3. They just weren't there. But here we see it. It's like a hod. She's giving him what he needs for his soul to feel necessary. And what about him? What's he doing? If you notice, let me go back to the verse. Who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? He's loving. Wilderness in our Bible is this, we've seen him like pursuing her and trying to woo her all throughout the poem, but like chapter 8, you get to, they're coming out of the wilderness. Wilderness in our Bible is a metaphor. In the ancient Near East, the wilderness is a place of danger, of wandering. It's a place of disorientation, emotionally, spiritually. It's a place of testing. She's been in the wilderness. They've been in the wilderness. And so what's he doing? She's leaning. He's walking at her pace. Steady, safe, present. He's not dragging her. He's not demanding. He's not dominating. He is, I'm with you. I think some of the most helpful words I've seen couples do after a really hard season is when one of them hugs the other and says, you know we're going to get through this, don't you? That's what he's offering her. You know we're going to get through this, don't you? He's putting on love. He is putting on love. He is putting on love. Each of them is giving what the other needs, and it may not be necessarily easy for them, but they have to put it on. They have to put it on. And then she responds with one of my favorite lines, period, but definitely in Song of Songs. She says, place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. It's jealousy unyielding as a grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, it would be utterly scorned. She speaks naturally her language of love. That's like a love, little love poem here. And notice also she speaks into what he needs, into respect. She says, place me like a seal. In other words, you protect me. You protect me. Your love is strong. You're loyal. You're You're always there. He loves her enough to give her what she needs. She respects him enough to give him what he needs. He's choosing love. She's choosing respect. And together, they form a chad. And this takes a lifetime to continue to develop. That's what I said last week. I'm in over my head. I've been married 14 years. But when you see couples who do this over the course of a lifetime, the two dots keep getting closer. I have a friend. When I first met him, I was new here, and I first met this gentleman, and I was new in marriage, and I had no kids at the time, and so I kind of said I owed it to myself, as weird as that sounds, to get to interview some people who I just thought were doing this right. And so I looked for older gentlemen who I thought were husbands that I kind of wanted to be like someday, and dads who felt like they had kids that loved them, and so I was looking for those kinds of inspirational figures, and I met this gentleman, and he was with his wife, and I was like, the way he treats her, like, I'm like, I would love to get to know this guy. So I invited him out to lunch, and we sit down at lunch, and I learn at lunch that he is actually a newlywed himself, and I asked some follow-up questions, because I had this list of questions that I asked all these people, and had a follow-up question, and he had said, I was actually married for well over, I think, 45, 46 years, and then she passed away, and so I got remarried, and my wife, he used her name, but he's like, she's an incredible woman, and then he said to me, but man, I wish you would have had a chance to meet my wife, and he pulled out a picture of he was younger and she was younger and they had younger kids in this picture. And she said, he said, I just wish you would have had a chance. She was such an incredible woman. I wish you would have had a chance to meet her. And it wasn't because he didn't love his now wife. He did. He treated her great. He actually said at one point, he said, the hardest part about being in a new church is that nobody knows her. Nobody knows her. They just know me, and they just kind of assume that we've been together our whole lives, and that's okay. I don't correct people, but he's like, I really wish you would have known her. Love, according to Song of Songs, is as strong as death, and talking to him, I think he would argue it's actually a bit stronger. That is a chad. Last week, Monday, I get a text message. This is in response to the sermon from last week, which I had titled Old and Boring. So get a text message in response to that saying, I kind of disagree. Let me read you. It was in good spirit, the way it was very kindly written. This is what was spoken of. This woman has been married for 60 years. She did not give me permission to use her name, so I will not use her name. But she's been married for 60 years, and she texted me this. She said, this week's topic, so the old and boring sermon, has been misnamed. You would not believe how much fun we have, especially with other couples. How freeing it can be to be less inhibited. You would not. Old and boring. Now, shows how much you know. That is a hot. When I was 14, I saw the movie Titanic. My aunt took me. Let that settle in. yeah, I was every bit as awkward as you can imagine. But if you haven't seen the movie, I actually rewatched it recently, and it's an incredible movie. But Rose and Jack, you know, they form this love, different worlds, they come together, and they have this love that will never let go. That's the story. And it's also fiction. It's not a true story. And it had me curious as I was watching this movie, and are there any people from the Titanic whose story we know that may be similar to this particular story? Turns out there is. Their names are Isidore and Ida Strauss. Now, there's a picture of Isidore and Ida Strauss. Apparently, by the way, I just learned this, that they were shown in the movie. Like, not obviously them, but actors portraying them. Here's their story. They met shortly after the Civil War. He was broke. They met, and he was basically penniless. And like a lot of people do in that era, when you need to find money, you move to New York City. So he moved to New York City, And yada, 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 after a lot of hard work and a lot of time, he ended up going in with his brother on the purchase of a small shop called Macy's. That Macy's. He eventually made his way onto the U.S. House of Representatives. So he becomes quite successful. He ends up making his way onto the Titanic, and because he's quite successful, when they realize the Titanic is going down, he is offered a spot on one of the lifeboats. He refuses. He says, as long as there are women and children that have not secured spots, I refuse to take a raft until every one of them has a spot on first. That's pretty noble. So then it was offered to his wife, Ida, and she was offered a spot. She refused. This is what she said. I will not be separated from my husband. As we have lived, so will we die together. She then allegedly gave a mink coat to one of her to her maid and said, you take my spot on the raft. I have no use for this coat anymore. And the last known appearance of Isidore and Ida together was on the deck of the Titanic before it went down. In Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx, New York, there is a plaque. And on that plaque are these words. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. That's Song of Songs. That's a hod. That's a hod. A little over a decade ago, I did a funeral service for a gentleman, and prior to any funeral, I like to gather up the close friends and family and get to know them a little bit. I get to know some people a little, like, from this setting, but you're all far more interesting than I know of you, and so I like to get to hear the stories, and I heard some stories about this gentleman. He was a hoot. I really liked him, and I heard about their camping trips and family vacations and the little inside jokes that they had as a family. And then his daughter spoke, and it's what she said that really left an impression. She said, Tim, I wish you would have known Dad. I know you guys hit it off, but I wish you would have known Dad when my mom was alive. Those two were the dynamic duo. That was the dynamic duo. So I said, "Well, tell me about them. Like, I am curious about the dynamic duo." She said that they had been married for I don't know the number, many, many years. They were older, and a couple years prior to his passing, her mother had passed away, and they shared some stories about the dynamic duo with me, and one stuck with me. She told me about how throughout their whole marriage, as little kids, they would overhear from time to time, mom and dad, often playfully, sometimes not playfully, in the morning talk about, mom especially would say, you were on my side of the bed again last night. Maybe that's a thing in your marriage. You got your side, she's got her side, you don't cross sides. And so they said that was kind of their thing, and it was often playful, but like, yeah, he would sometimes get like, you know, he was bigger and he'd get on her side and she would jab him back and get back on your side. And then mom passed, and then dad's health started to decline, and they got to a spot where they realized they need to bring hospice into the home. And if you've ever brought in hospice into your home, you know, there's a series of decisions you get to make. And one of them that they encourage often is to move the bed into a larger room so that there's more access for nurses and if there are family or neighbors or friends that want to pop by. So often they will move the bed into the living room. And that's what they did. And so they move his bed into the living room and they're placing him on the bed. And the daughter tells me that they put him in the center and he starts kind of inching over. His health is failing at this time. And she said, no, Dad, you should be in the center. It's safer in the center. Just stay in the center of the bed. We don't want you rolling off. Just stay in the center of the bed. To which she then got very emotional in the room, understandably why. And she said, he said to me, I can't be on that side of the bed. Honey, that's your mother's side of the bed. And she doesn't like it when I go over there. And then he said, she reflected to me that he said, but sometimes at night I forget it. And I wake up and I forget that she's gone, and I will reach over to rub her arm as I have done for so many years, and she's not there. And then he said, but she will be again soon. That's Ahad. And that's held up as, for us, like Paul says, you want to understand the mystery of our God and his great love for his church. Look at a marriage. Look at a marriage that's been doing it for a minute, who's worked their way up, who has grown closer to God. Look for a marriage who has placed God as that third strand, where even if it doesn't come naturally to put on love or respect, they've chosen to do that. And over the course of a lifetime together, they have found themselves in a place where two are like one. That has been my prayer for you. Some of you have let me into some of your marriage stuff. We all have it. Every one of us has it. And so some of you have let me into some of yours. And there's been a handful of names. Some of you let us into it as pastors. And so there's been a handful of you all that we have been praying for throughout the series. And there have been a handful of Sundays where we've said, I really hope so-and-so, I hope they're here this Sunday. And we pray for that. Like, I really want them to hear this, and I don't want them to hear me wrong. You know, you always run the risk of saying something not well and somebody mishearing you or interpreting things you're not trying to say. So I really hope I don't miscommunicate this piece. And it dawned on me this week as I was putting together this sermon that I really want your marriages to thrive. I really do. And it dawned on me that if I want your marriages to make it this badly, how much more invested is our God in seeing you make this? Would you join me in a word of prayer? Lord, for those who are in a space where they look back at a life of laughter and love, we are just grateful for all of the little miscommunications and little conflicts that got them there. Lord, we're so grateful. And Lord, for every couple who is wondering about whether or not this thing has any life left in it, Lord, we pray that you would do what I can't do. Lord, your words, your spirit would speak to their hearts, the words that they need to hear. Lord, for every single one of us, would you help us to see that our identity is found in a life of pursuing you? Lord, that's where our value and our worth come from. Jesus, we pray all of this in your name. And everybody said,
for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.